Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Henry A. Giroux. The author of more than 50 books, he is certainly one of the world's most important living intellectuals. He writes on a tremendous variety of topics, but central to all of his work are the importance of radical democracy, the importance of education, the importance of critical thinking and discourse, and the effects of capitalism on all these. In 2002, he was named one of the top 50 educational thinkers of the modern period. So thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Okay, so I would like to start with a quote from one of your recent essays and then just go from there. And what you said is that under the regime of neoliberalism, especially in the United States, war has become an extension of politics as almost all aspects of society have been transformed into a combat zone. Americans now live in a society in which almost everyone is spied on, considered a potential terrorist, and subject to a mode of state and corporate lawlessness in which the arrogance of power knows no limits. So can you talk about what that means, what you're saying there?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that the notion of violence has become so institutionalized and so widespread that it touches almost every aspect of daily and public life. I mean, we see it being waged not only being waged in terms of foreign affairs, but we also see it being waged on a domestic front in a way that's enormously intensified since the 1980s. We see it being waged against peaceful student protesters. We see it being waged against people whose social protections are being taken away. We see it being waged against public institutions that are not defined by the logic of the commodity. We see it being waged against what you might call reason itself, even intelligence. We see it being waged basically in local communities where police forces are now being turned into SWAT teams, being given the latest technologies, war technologies that are being imported from Iraq and Afghanistan. I guess what I was trying to say is that the value systems that now shape American society are warlike. They're about competitiveness. They're about a hyper-competitiveness. They're about a hyper-kind of masculinity. They operate off the assumption that the best way to solve problems is basically through violence or through punitive measures. Endless numbers of behaviors are being criminalized. So I think that what this all adds up to is really an assumption that rather than being alive to public spheres that encourage cooperation, solidarity, and a whole range of other really important social relations, we now find ourselves operating in places in which we're consistently under attack, particularly by the 1% corporate power and a whole range of other fundamentalist institutions.
So I have, of course, agree with what you're saying, and I'm wondering. I mean, there is a strain in this culture that goes way back, and capitalism and empire have both obviously been based on naked force when necessary and rhetoric when it will work. But what is different now?
I think there are a number of things that are different. I think that, you know, as capitalism began to emerge, particularly in the United States in full force prior to the 1980s, I mean, two things are important to stress here. One, the relationship between power and the state was as such that power was basically confined by and subject to, in some ways, the rules of the nation state. The nation state basically could modify and limit the worst of capitalist atrocities and power at times. We saw it in the deal. We saw it in the Great Society. Secondly, it seems to me that we also saw a period in which political concessions kind of mattered. I mean, the relationship between capital and labor was a very delicate one at times, particularly for the upper stratum of society. They had to, in some way, appease workers. You know, we had to give them social protections and so forth and so on. I think what has happened since then, and what is distinctively new in my mind, is that, first of all, power now floats. It's global. I mean, it has no concerns whatsoever. It's it's separated from politics as a local phenomenon. And hence, as a result of that, it has no allegiances to anything. The notion of political concessions is actually a joke. They don't make the upper ruling class, they don't make political concessions anymore. They're too arrogant. Workers don't like it, we'll go to Mexico. We take away people's pensions, they get pissed off, too bad. You know, we'll just simply go to another town. And I think the other side of this is that what has happened in the midst of that separation of power and politics and the dissolution of political concessions is we've seen emerge what I call a real excessive, mean-spirited sort of culture of cruelty. I mean, we find ourselves inhabiting a kind of zombie-like set of social formations in which mimics reality TV. You know, there's only one person left in the island. Any form of social sharing or social compassion is seen as a mark of disdain or as scornful or is seen as pathological. All the basic solidarities are being constantly undermined. I mean, we don't have a war on poverty anymore. We have a war on the poor. We have a war on homeless people. We have a war on low-income youth. We have a war being waged against poor minority youth. And it's being waged, and of course, the reproductive rights of women and gays, but it's being waged with a vengeance. I mean, there are no apologies. The social contract and the language of the social contract are really, for all intent and purposes, now dead.
And I know you've said this, you know, you've already said this in this conversation a little bit, but can you talk more about the mechanics of how that has become to be in place? And I'm thinking one of the things that I write about a lot and I find really important and interesting is the way the interlocks between philosophy, politics, repression, etc., how it's a sort of an integrated system. So how has that come to pass where that war has been, how did we move from the Great Society to from the war on poverty to the war on the poor? What were some of the steps in that? You've talked about globalization. What are some of the other necessary steps?
I think that one of the things that's happened that very few people on the left really want to talk about, and I think it's in many ways it's contributed to the great failure of the left, is that there really is a new moment in history between cultural institutions, political power, and everyday life. And what I mean by that, to go back and to echo maybe Gramsci and C. Wright Mills, is that cultural apparatuses now are largely responsible in many ways for the darkness that surrounds the United States. What we see happening in the 1980s is not only the consolidation of the corporate media and all those cultural apparatuses that are really crucial in shaping particular kinds of identities, subjectivities, desires, motivations, and some sort of understanding of how to relate to oneself, the world, to others, and to the globe in general. But we see it done with such intensity. This cultural war that the right has waged through a kind of public neoliberal public pedagogy in which, you know, we're told that, for instance, all problems are basically individual problems, that then there are no longer any social problems. I mean, this is the merging of Reagan and Thatcher, right? That society doesn't matter. All that matters are individuals, and that government is the problem rather than the answer. And I think that particular ideology, that particular notion of freedom, the individualization of the social, the refusal to encourage and to repress the translation of private issues and troubles into larger public considerations has taken an enormously terrible, terrible turn in terms of basically providing the despicable formative cultures that now enable people to internalize a whole range of neoliberal considerations that now normalize themselves as common sense and basically infantilize and depoliticize people. Remember, you know, if one wanted to talk about the most important educative force or ideology in the United States, I mean, in my mind, it's consumerism. I mean, there's a consumerist logic out there that says the only obligation of citizenship is basically to shop, to be a consumer. And if you're not a consumer, something's wrong with you. You know, you're part of that increasingly disposable population that really doesn't matter anymore because you're not really contributing to the economy. I mean, I think the other side of this is that there's an enormous fear in the culture, particularly since 9/11, that seems to suggest that the only thing that really matters is survival, and that you have to be very careful not only about what it means to be able to survive on a daily level through an adequate job, housing, work, and all that sort of thing. But in terms of what you say, when you see a state attack its young people as intensively as it's done in the last few years, particularly since 2011, and you learn that you have a state that's monitoring every aspect of your behavior, two things are happening there. One is that people are being beaten down by virtue of simply the need to increasingly just survive. And secondly, there's a cultural fear that seems to suggest that, watch out, that, you know, what you say or what you do could certainly get you not only in trouble, but could actually land you in prison.
You know, I'm thinking about that on a local scale. I live in Crescent City, California, which is a tiny town on the border of Oregon on the coast. And it's basically, the politics here are basically sort of Mississippi on the north coast.
Right.
And the local sheriff has made a huge point of politicizing his role. And he calls environmentalists the enemy. And he is more known for his secessionist politics than he is actually for anything having to do with the law. And the point is that just a couple days ago there was a – but here's the point is that – no one, frankly, in this town, except for me, is publicly talking about the fact that it's really problematical to have the armed leader of an armed paramilitary organization who is strongly pushing a political perspective. Because if you speak out, if I speak out against a supervisor, they can just say, wow, we don't really like each other. But if I speak out against him, he can destroy my life because he's a cop.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. That's Derek. It's very important. I mean, I think there was also a third category that you had just brought up that I meant to mention and was going to mention, and that is, you know, the increasing militarization of American society. I mean, remember, you know, this is a country. The United States is a country in which the public believes that the most revered and honored people in that country are both the police and the military. And I think that when you see that sort of militarization spread out and touch everything from popular culture to everyday life to the increasing criminalization of social problems to also the notion that the police somehow were immune and somehow beyond the law, I mean, particularly in small towns like the one you're in, you have a very direct relationship with that oppressive sort of state power. And it stifles people. I mean, I think the other side of this is that people also believe that in spite of those kinds of authoritarian, anti-democratic practices and tendencies in institutions and individuals, you know, the politics itself has dissolved into a pathology. And that, you know, we know that money controls the country. People know that. They know that most politicians are simply frauds. They know that there's very little difference between the Democratic and public and the Republican Party. And the only way in which people seem to be able to deal with this is to either become very cynical or to collapse into their sort of privatized orbits in which they just sort of care about themselves and celebrate their own sense of self-interest. So as long as they're not being arrested, you know, as long as their houses are not being attacked by SWAT teams, it really doesn't seem to matter. And I think this confluence of forces has created such an authoritarian sense of fear and repression in the United States that it's almost overwhelming. And I think, as my friend Stanley Aronowitz and others have argued, this is not just simply a political issue. This is an educational issue, as you suggested. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what does it mean to make education central to politics itself? What does it mean to be able to change the way people think? What does it mean to develop cultural apparatuses that are actively involved in providing counter memories, different forms of moral witnessing, a different political language? I mean, my argument would be that what you've just said about that town and about many of the people in it who probably support the sheriff lock, stock, and barrel is that they lack the language. You know, they have no way of, they don't know what community means anymore. They think it means going to the mall. Democracy means shopping. You know, freedom means doing anything you want or owning a gun. I mean, the language of democracy and solidarity and public life and public trust have been so devalued and trivialized that we find ourselves in a kind of discursive political void, which makes it very difficult to imagine what a sense of critique might be and what the alternatives might be.
You have you've titled a book, The Violence of Organized Forgetting. And That, of course, reminds me of that great quote about the struggle of man against power is a struggle of memory against forgetting.
Right.
And can you, I mean, you seem to be leading up to that. Can you talk about that book a little bit and talk especially about the notion and organized forgetting and the importance of remembering?
Well, I think there are a couple of things at work. I mean, the subtitle for that book, as you know, is Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine. And I think that what I'm trying to highlight in the book is that there is a cultural apparatus out there that not only trivializes, it seems to me, important social issues or utterly privatizes them, but it actually erases them. You know, I mean, you know, we don't want to talk about racism. We don't want to talk about poverty. Fortunately, we are talking about inequality, but we don't want to talk about the mass incarceration system. We don't want to talk about the rise of the punishing state. We don't want to talk about the fact that increasingly most of our institutions are now being modeled after prisons. I mean, these are subjects that all of a sudden have fallen into a kind of, what might you call it, a kind of black hole of moral and political indifference. And I think that it becomes very crucial to recognize that without that sense of memory, without a sense of previous struggles, without a sense of the historical context that gave rise to a lot of the issues that we're facing today, whether it be neoliberal capitalism or the rise of the punishing state, we have no context to understand them, and hence we tend to normalize them. We tend to believe that that's the way it is. There's no other way to look at the world except through the eyes of this 1%, these financial criminals, you know, who now basically run the United States. I mean, we're now engaged in this in a form of corporate sovereignty that has really displaced any viable notion of political sovereignty. So I guess that common sense now begins to trump a reason, just as ignorance becomes the new normal. I mean, when you have people in both the Democratic and Republican parties claiming, and pundits, these anti-public intellectuals, claiming that climate change, they don't believe in climate change. You know, I mean, you get some sort of sense of the death wish that actually drives what they're about. This is a new kind of illiteracy. It's an illiteracy that's on the side of death. It's an illiteracy that makes a huge investment in short-term gains and believes that long-term gains and long-term investments are irrelevant because the only thing they could probably benefit would be the common good, and they don't care about the common good. They don't care about the social contract, and they don't care about other people. This is about the death of memory, but it's also about the death of ethics and the death of social responsibility. And one could probably argue, if we take Hannah Arendt seriously and we recognize the kind of thoughtlessness that's now being paraded as a form of civic literacy, it's about the death of politics itself.
Well, and I would also argue it's about the death of the planet, too.
And it's about the death of the planet, absolutely.
And the poor and blah, blah, blah. I mean, everybody. It's omnicidal. I want to go back for a second. I want to come back to this whole death urge. And I think that's very, very important. But I want to step back for a second. And when you were talking about this avoidance of talking about important things, I kept thinking about this line by R.D. Lang, which is he came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. And what this means within the context of an abusive family is you can talk about anything you want in the entire world. You can talk about the Toronto Blue Jays. You can talk about the New York Yankees. You can talk about football. You can talk about weather. But you can't talk about the violence that you have to pretend isn't happening. And I see that how that's so applicable on a larger scale that – you know, one of the things I've done at talks, I used to do at talks more often, is I would be just talking about the murder of the planet, and then I would stop, and I would start talking about Angelina Jolie, and then talk about Brad Pitt. And I'd go on about them for a couple of minutes, everybody's sort of laughing nervously, like, what is he doing? And then I would stop, and I would say, okay, what is the indigenous name for the land where you live? And then I would say, name 10 species of edible plants and fungi who live within 100 yards of your home. And the point I was trying to highlight is that we all know who Brad and Angelina are, but most of us don't know anything about where we live. We don't know the history. We don't know the ecology. And so it's what do we know and what do we not know? I mean, we know that America's Got Talent has started again, so all must be good in the world.
I think there's a larger question that haunts those kinds of examples. I mean, beyond the idiocy of celebrity culture, as being the most important element of our culture. I mean, I think the real question here is, you know, what kind of social formations, what kind of cultural formations are in place that basically enable those kinds of subjectivities to be produced? How is it that people basically begin to celebrate and define themselves by a kind of civic illiteracy in which they can name Brad Pitt, but can't name anything at all that might be relevant to saving the planet or even saving their own lives or even contesting the kinds of forces that they need to fight against if they're going to survive in a world that in any way takes the question of justice, equality, and meaning seriously. I mean, I think that the question that haunts me around that kind of description is that, you know, look, we're producing subjects and modes of identities and desires that are entirely market driven. And that paradigm, not only is it evil by virtue of what it celebrates, you know, profit making is the essence of democracy, the rational belief that, you know, the economy can not only, that the markets can not only define the economy, but all of social life, or that, you know, we need to dismantle public, private, we need to dismantle the unions and the welfare state, and all of that. It also seems to suggest that thinking is an act of stupidity. And I think that this really gets at the core of something crucial, and that is, what is it about this moment in history in the United States in which, what is it that makes education so dangerous? I mean, what is it that, why is there such an incredibly hostile move towards an attack on public education, on higher education, on alternative media? I mean, one could argue that the consolidation of class power in the United States depends upon a certain kind of ignorance. And I think that we've never seen that in such full bloom as we see it now. So these people who are, you know, who know the names of celebrities and everything about them, or everything you could mention about sports or a sports team, but are completely illiterate around civic issues, are really functioning within a kind of educational void in which social, political, and moral indifference actually becomes the norm rather than the exception. And we have to address that. I mean, that needs to be addressed. I mean, we need to figure out how that happens, you know, what it means, and what we've ignored, particularly those who are progressives and on the left, around the educative nature of politics itself.
Well, apart from the fact that they've got a lot of money, what is it that the right has done so successfully to push their ideologies that the left has failed at? What have been some of our failures on the left in terms of effectively countering everything from this anti-intellectualism to the assaults on the poor or the subcontract?
I can give you three things right off that come to the top of my head.
Uh-huh.
First, I think the left has been involved in an endless series of identity politics in which it's become so fragmented that it really fails to bring these groups together in some sort of comprehensive understanding of how the system actually works. And in doing so, it's disempowered in many ways. Secondly, it seems to me that the left has not taken seriously the notion of education as central to politics, because it's basically been concerned about the way in which economics drives politics. It's almost completely ignored the question of subjectivity in ways that matter, and hence has not fought over those cultural apparatuses that the right took seriously. Public schools, the media, a whole range of other alternative schools, a whole range of institutions that are not simply about money, but about simply figuring out ways to provide the formative culture that allows people to understand what it means to inhabit a sense of agency that matters. I mean, thirdly, it seems to me that we have not done enough to create a massive social movement that in some way would provide an alternative to established politics. I mean, you know, remember, many people on the left, particularly the liberal left, is now the center right. I mean, these people have basically put their faith in people like Obama and have refused to understand that the system is so utterly corrupt, so beyond the pale, that it's, you know, to work within it would have to be very strategic around very particular reforms, but that the most important thing is to really offer an alternative and try to imagine and develop some kind of notion of a radical imagination in which we can imagine a completely different system, one not based on profit and accumulation of capital and massive forms of inequality and a war against the planet.
I'm really enjoying this interview, and one of the things that's very difficult from my perspective through this particular conversation is that the interview is so rich, and there's like 35 different things or 50 different things you've said so far that each one could be an entire book. And I want to go back to what you said a moment ago. That's why I keep going back to things, is because I'm grabbing something. It's like, oh, wait, we got to talk about this.
No, I'm sorry. I'm often including too many things.
No. I'm not making a backhanded insult. I think it's fabulous. I think that this is one of the things you're doing. It's very clear to me is that you are manifesting in your intellectualism. You're manifesting precisely what you're talking about not being atomized, because you're reaching to the connections between education, the perception of capitalism and the equivalence of capitalism and democracy, mass murder, state imprisonment. You're putting all those things together in this fabulous stew. And so this was in no way am I saying you're doing anything wrong. What I'm saying is that it's fabulous. And also, as I'm interviewing you, I'm going, holy crap, we got to hold on to all these different things. And so,
but I think you've just hit something, Derek, that I really like, and I must say is central to my work, though I wish I were better at it. And that is, we often don't bring together those things that we tend to look at as being isolated. So we miss the most comprehensive understanding of how certain pathologies and anti-democratic tendencies in the society actually work. I mean, one classic example, which I'm sure you know especially, but it's, you know, most people miss. How can you talk about the attack, for instance, on public education in the United States by not talking about neoliberalism? How can you do that? I mean, or the rise of a militarized society, or the rise of a punishing state. This is not just about testing. You know, it's not just about, you know, really stupid standards. It's not just about getting kids to memorize nonsense and then to sort of reward them for it, or to sort of attack the unions, or to basically turn teachers, to take away the power of teachers and to turn them into de-skilled technicians. It's about much more than that. There's a much larger issue at stake. And the larger issue at stake is we don't believe in democracy anymore, that democracy is dangerous, that it doesn't serve us well. We can speak in the name of democracy, but we will not, under any circumstances, support those institutions that in any way promote it. And we will punish people who basically believe that. And we'll do it in a variety of ways. We'll do it through the ideological state apparatus, through the schools, through the media. We'll shame people. We'll close them out. Or we'll do it through the punishing state. And the degree to which we'll criminalize more and more behavior is the degree to which we'll intensify the culture of fear and make it clear that these two moments, the ideological and the repressive, work together in a way that really defines a new kind of authoritarianism in the United States.
So we're doing it again, too, because I want to talk about the new kind of authoritarianism, but I also want to go back to what you said about finding democracy to be dangerous. And I completely agree with you, except they would disagree and say, no, democracy is wonderful, but one of the things they've done, which you've written about, is they've conflated democracy doesn't actually mean democracy. Democracy to them actually means capitalism.
They don't even use the word democracy anymore. They don't like the word. They actually now are so arrogant, they talk about free market capitalism. And they assume that it means democracy to everybody else because they really believe they've won the cultural war. They really believe that most people believe in the market. No, most people are not interested in non-market values, and that most people will not fight for them. I mean, that's why you see this enormous hysteria that's emerging now on the right around inequality. Because all of a sudden, because of Piketty's book, you know, on Capital, and a whole range of other people who are actually much better than him, you know, talking about inequality, this is, and of course the Occupy movement, this is now part of the central conversation about what the United States represents. And they're really frightened of that. I mean, they really hate that discourse. They do not want to go there. That's the last thing they want to do. They want to talk about, you know, they want to talk about Libya, Benghazi. You know, they want to talk about whether Hillary Clinton has brain damage. I mean, that's what they want to talk about. But it seems to me, if you want to measure how they feel about democracy, the issue is not to say, okay, look, they use the term. The issue is, what do they do, in what way do they wage an assault and a war against those modes of culture, modes of thinking, and institutions that actually are fundamental to democracy? And it seems to me that's where the left has really got to take seriously what it means to explore alternatives to capitalism, because it has to in some way provide in-depth analysis of not only of the trends of neoliberal capitalism and how it works as an ideology, how it works as a mode of governance and producing particular kinds of subjects, how it works in terms of policies in which, you know, it eliminates government regulation of financial institutions and corruptions, or eliminates the welfare state, or how it functions as a form of public pedagogy. I mean, in terms of the kinds of values and social relationships that it highlights, the way it degrades collaboration and tears up all forms of social obligation. So these are the kinds of issues that need to be made central to that kind of concern.
And how do we do that?
I think we do it in a number of ways. I mean, my good friend Stanley Aronowitz recently has a piece coming out in Tikkun, in which he claims that there are three things that need to be done, among others. And he says, first of all, we need to revive the radical imagination. We really need to talk. We need to really not just talk. We need to employ not just a language of critique, but a language of hope. We need to develop a movement for the national defense for public goods and for democracy itself, so that we can talk about the relationship between the two. That's really quite important. Secondly, it seems to me, as he says, we need to launch a comprehensive education program in some fundamental way through the alternative media, the creation of alternative schools, any way we can in which we can take seriously and develop the educative nature of politics. And thirdly, it seems to me that we need in some way to launch, as he points out, a new left political formation. I mean, a left that doesn't eliminate identity politics, that's silly. And I certainly would not argue for that. But a left that can bring these various groups together so that we can either talk about one of three things: creating an international social movement in which it crosses borders and is able to in some way address the pathologies of capital on a global level and try in some way to mobilize people to do that. Or secondly, just create a new political party in ways that are more democratic and less hierarchical. Or thirdly, create a new social formation based on federations, you know, different regions of the country and, you know, these horizontal formations that can then come together. But what is crucial to all of this is that the left has to find appropriate forms to enable democratic self-management, political and economic institutions. It has to, in some way, think about what it means to pursue a program. I mean, what are we going to offer the American people that they absolutely need? We want to, you know, we want to raise incomes. We want to tax the rich. We want to do the public ownership of utilities. We want to campaign for national health care. All the things that basically, it seems to me, would touch in a very profound and meaningful way 9/10 of the population. I mean, we just can't talk about this stuff. We have to have actually Michael Lerner has a program which he calls the New Marshall Plan for both the sustaining the planet and an economic, an educational plan. And, you know, one can find a whole range of things wrong with it, but at least he's offering alternatives that make sense. It's not enough to simply fall into that cynical role of simply providing a language of critique, which is important, but it has to be accompanied by a language of hope. And it has to be accompanied by strategic plans that bring together social movements that can begin to work out, it seems to me, a program that will really mobilize and take hold and move the American public.
What? Yeah. I'm just thinking, as you're talking about that, I think that's obviously really crucial stuff. And I want to go back and see if we can tie this together. I want to go back to what you were saying about the the death urge. The you know, you've got a book called Zombie Politics and yes, Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism. So I want to come back to what we do in a moment, but I want to go back because I think one of the biggest problems we're facing is the death urge on the part of those in power and sort of the larger cultural movement. And one of the things that I've said a lot is that I don't, and don't get me wrong, I mean, all of my work is about creating the necessary social change to stop this culture from killing the planet, stop the atrocities we see around us, and I am untiring in that, and part of my analysis is that some of the problems that we face are not fundamentally rational, and so therefore they're not amenable to rational solutions. So, you know, I want to give one more example real quick. I did a talk at this place called Bioneers several years ago, and it's all about social change, and I was really frustrated because I was the only person there who talked about either power or psychopathology, and I don't understand how you can talk about social change without also talking about power, and I don't understand how you can talk about the murder of the planet without talking about psychopathology. And so I'm wondering, I mean, you may disagree with all this, I don't know, so where does this machinery of social and civil death, where does that fit into what I'm talking about with this death urge, or is it something entirely different?
No, I actually write about that myself, and I'm entirely with you, both in terms of the conceptual apparatus and the language. I mean, I think that what we're both trying to say, or at least what I'm trying to say, I certainly can't speak for you, but I think that what the associations that you're making, that I make, and I make them very strongly in the zombie book, is that capitalism equals death.
Yes.
It equals death. That, and the people who basically enforce that formula are basically psychopaths.
Yes.
I mean, a psychopath is a person or an institution, so to speak, that has no concern for the social cost in terms of its actions. It has no sense of responsibility. It lives in a moral vacuum. It cares only about itself, and it tends to wreak nothing but, it seems to me, the worst kinds of human suffering and misery upon people simply to elevate its own interest. That to me is something that not only embodies a death wish, but actually embodies a form of civil and social death. And I think we need to name it as such. That's a particular mode of authoritarianism. Authoritarianism, it seems to me, is on the side not of life, in the sense of a vital sense of what it means to be alive and live in a democracy in which people share responsibilities, share the resources, and share a certain sense of collective dignity. It's on the side of basically a political formation, an ideology, and a mode of government that takes governance, that takes as its essence the fact that it doesn't give a shit about anybody else and it doesn't care about the social cost involved. And that, to me, is a metaphor for political death. And I think we need to make those associations. I mean, you know, capitalism isn't about the free market. It's about the death wish. It's a death wish. It's a death wish for the planet. It's a death wish for the commons. It's a death wish for democracy. And I think that language is crucial. And I think, you know, and I know there actually now are a number of scientific studies coming out looking at ruling class groups and claiming that they suffer from all kinds of social pathologies, that they're greedy, they're self-interested, they don't care about other people, they're provincial, they're removed from most of the planet, they live in gated communities, that they basically are increasingly inhabit a kind of psychopathic world. And I think that when you allow people to rule the planet and to rule the political system who are psychopaths, you have to ask yourself, what's wrong here? You know, what have we missed? What needs to be unraveled? How do we make power visible in terms of what it's doing in terms of that death wish? In other words, does the referent for the death wish become central to the analysis itself?
And once we've made, and this is, now I want to bring this back to the organizing. Once we've made that, and I love everything you just said, once we make that a part of our analysis and we speak it and then what do we do next? We've got about 5 minutes left, and what do we? You've also written about the importance of recognizing that this is a long struggle, and recognizing that there's not going to be any sort of Walt Disney-like sudden epiphany where the world changes in 3 seconds because we wish it does. But instead, you've written about the importance of organizing. Can you talk about, can you bring together that, well, three things. Bring together the analysis of the death wish and, or death urge, and then organizing, and then also something we haven't gotten to talk about, but I think is really crucial. We've certainly talked around it a lot, but your public intellectuals project.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, okay, let's see if we can integrate these three things in ways that speak to the question you've raised. I mean, I think that first of all, we need to integrate the notion of critique and hope. You know, we need to both have some kind of analysis of capitalism and what it's doing and the utter destruction that it's wreaking upon individuals and families in a way that really makes sense to people. We need to produce a discourse that is meaningful in order to be critical, in order to be transformative. So we need to really focus on that educated part of the political struggle, and what that means. Secondly, we can't do that alone. We have to do it locally, and we have to do it globally, and we have to do it at a federal level, and we have to do it globally. So we need to find and join groups that basically are working in ways to address these issues. Maybe it starts with the school board, you know, and moves out. But we need to find places where we can bring these issues together, and we can mobilize in ways that produce social formations that take them seriously. Thirdly, of course, you know, there is the question of intellectuals in this culture and what responsibilities they have. And there's the question of the public institutions that support them and how they need to be basically harnessed and saved. I mean, I would argue right now one of the most important struggles that people can engage in is saving public and higher education. Because if that terrain falls to the right wings, to the right wing, the hedge fund operators, the privateers, the billionaires club, we're in big trouble. There'll be so few spaces left in which people can actually begin to talk to each other and in some way develop a sense of critique and a sense of possibility and a sense of social movement. Then we're all in trouble. And I think we need to assume that, you know, everybody's an intellectual here. I mean, people make strategic interventions in different ways. So we've got to keep this conversation going in ways that raise the bar about how it is that we can come to analyze the nature of our own subjectivities and what it means to imagine a different future, whether we do it with alternative media, whether we do it with struggle over schools, whether we do it in the social formations that we create, whether we do it with alternative schools. This is really the crucial issue right now. At least I think it is.
So a question that is political but is a little bit more personal that I've been dying to ask is, I'm one of the most prolific writers I know, with serious writers, with I've got more than 20 books out, and you are way more prolific than I am. And
I'm a lot older than you are.
Well, I think what I'm looking for here is a political sort of an inspirational statement. I mean, one of the ways that I write as much as I do is because I don't actually write books. What I do is my great grandmother often said, "Inch by inch, life's a cinch." And so I write a page, then I write a page, and I write a page, and before you know it, I've got a book. And I think about that with social change too. That instead of trying to destroy capitalism in one step, you know, we do this today, we do that tomorrow. And how do you write so much? And I write so much because I'm on fire, because the world's being killed. And if I can make any difference with any of my work, I'm going to work as hard as I can. So why and how do you work so hard?
I love your answer. I mean, you actually gave the answer. I mean, I hate human suffering, and I can't stand to see people suffering by virtue of exploitive systems that take them for granted. I'm a working class kid. I grew up in a working class neighborhood. There was a sense of real solidarity. There was a sense of real struggle. I heard stories about unions, the Wobblies, and all that sort of thing, and it never left me. I mean, that sensibility provides a sense of the ethical imagination for me, and then to move from there to, you know, you work with the tools that you have that can, you know, allows you to use those resources in ways that, you know, will work the best. You know, as Joe Lewis once said, and I think that that's what I do. You know, but I write a lot because, you know, I'm not just an academic. I also see myself as a public intellectual, and I started the Public Intellectual Project, and I'm really committed to that and another project I'm doing called Disposable Futures that really demands that I write a lot. So I read a lot and I write a lot. And my writing are political interventions like yours, you know, and I feel like I'm on fire because I think that we don't have a lot of time left. And I think that the moment is so crucial and the sense of urgency is so great that you just take what you can do best and, you know, hopefully it'll make a difference.
And one last question. What would you like listeners to this interview, what do you want them to take away and what do you want them to actually do? How do you want them to change?
I think the most important thing we can do is not blame ourselves. This system wants us to blame ourselves for the problems that we face every day. And I want them to realize that they're not alone and that we can learn to translate private issues into public considerations. And we can do it not just as individuals, but as groups. And it seems to me that history is open. It's not closed. And that we need to take a chance. We need to take risks. We need to demand the impossible. Because it seems to me that if we don't, then we're going to find ourselves in very dark times, not just for ourselves, but for our children. We have an obligation to make resistance not just simply imperative, but an absolute necessity.
Well, it has been such an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Derek.
And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Henry A. Giroux. This is Derek Jensen for the Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.